Epilogue. Winding the Death Watch 2. Glancing over my shoulder, I see its shape and so move forward, as someone in the woods at night might hear the sound of approaching feet and stop to listen. Then, instead of silence, he hears some creature trying to be silent. What else can he do but run? Rushing blindly down the path, stumbling, struck in the face by sticks, the other ever closer, yet not really hurrying or out of breath, teasing its kill. Stephen Dobbins, Pursuit. If I had some wings, I'd fly you all around. If I had some money, I'd buy you the goddamn town. If I had the strength, then maybe I could have pulled you through. If I had a lantern, I'd light the way for you. If I had a lantern, I'd light the way for you. Michael McDermott, Lantern. On January 2nd, 1994, Lois Chass became Lois Roberts. Her son, Harold, gave her away. Harold's wife did not attend the ceremony. She was up in Bangor with what Ralph considered a highly suspect case of bronchitis. He kept his suspicions to himself, however, being far from disappointed at Jan Chass's failure to appear. The groom's best man was Detective John Lydecker, who still wore a cast on his right arm, but otherwise showed no signs of the assignment which had nearly killed him. He had spent 4 days in a coma, but Lydecker knew how lucky he was. In addition to the state trooper who had been standing beside him at the time of the explosion, 6 cops had died, 2 of them members of Lydecker's hand-picked team. The bride's maid of honor was her friend Simone Castingay, and at the reception, the first toast was made by a fellow who liked to say he used to be Joe Wise, but was now older and wiser. Trigger Vachon delivered a fractured but heartfelt follow-up, concluding with a wish that these two people gonna live to 150 and never know a day of the rheumatiz or constipations. When Ralph and Lois left the reception hall, the hair still full of rice thrown for the most part by Faye Chapin and the rest of the Harris Avenue old crocs, an old man with a book in his hand and a fine cloud of white hair floating around his head came walking up to them. He had a wide smile on his face.
"Congratulations, Ralph," he said. "Congratulations, Lois."
"Thanks, Dora," Ralph said. "We missed you," Lois told him. "Didn't you get your invitation? Faye said he'd give it to you."
"Oh, he gave it to me. Yes, oh yes, he did. But I don't go to those things if they're inside. Too stuffy. Funerals are even worse. Here, this is for you. I didn't wrap it because the arthritis is in my fingers too bad for stuff like that now."
Ralph took it. It was a book of poems called Concurring Beasts. The poet's name, Stephen Dobbins, gave him a funny little chill, but he wasn't quite sure why.
"Thanks," he told Dorrance. "Not as good as some of his later work, but good. Dobbins is very good."
"We'll read them to each other on our honeymoon," Lois said.
"That's a good time to read poetry," Dorrance said. "Maybe the best time. I'm sure you'll be very happy together."
He started off, then looked back.
"You did a great thing. The long-timers are very pleased."
He walked away. Lois looked at Ralph. What was he talking about? Do you know? Ralph shook his head. He didn't, not for sure, although he felt as if he should know. The scar on his arm had begun to tingle as it sometimes did, a feeling which was almost like a deep-seated itch. "Long-timers," she mused. "Maybe he meant us, Ralph. After all, we're hardly spring chickens these days, are we?" "That's probably just what he did mean," Ralph agreed. But he knew better, and her eyes said that, somewhere deep down, so did she. On that same day, and just as Ralph and Lois were saying their I do's, a certain wino with a bright green aura, one who actually did have an uncle in Dexter,
although the uncle hadn't seen this ne'er-do-well nephew for 5 years or more, was tramping across Strawford Park, slitting his eyes against the formidable glare of sun on snow. He was looking for returnable cans and bottles. Enough to buy a pint of whiskey would be great, but a pint of night train wine would do. Not far from the Port of Sand marked men, he saw a bright gleam of metal. It was probably just the sun reflecting off a bottle cap, but such things needed to be checked out. It might be a dime, although to the wino it actually seemed to have a goldy sort of gleam. It... Holy Judas! He cried, snatching up the wedding ring which lay mysteriously on top of the snow. It was a broad band, almost certainly gold. He tilted it to read the engraving on the inside. H.D. E.D. 8587. A pint? Hell no! This little baby was going to secure him a quart. Several quarts. Possibly a week's worth of quarts. Hurrying across the intersection of Witcham and Jackson, the one where Ralph Roberts had once almost fainted, the wino never saw the approaching Green Line bus. The driver saw him and put on his brakes, but the bus struck a patch of ice. The wino never knew what hit him. At one moment he was debating between Old Crow and Old Granddad. At the next he had passed into the darkness which awaits us all. The ring rolled down the gutter and disappeared into a sewer grate, and there it remained for a long, long time, but not forever. In Derry, things that disappear into the sewer system have a way, an often unpleasant one, of turning up. Ralph and Lois didn't live happily ever after. There really are no evers in the short-time world, happy or otherwise, a fact which Clotho and Lachesis undoubtedly knew well. They did live happily for quite some time, though. Neither of them liked to come right out and say these were the happiest years of all, because both remember their first partners in marriage with love and affection. But in their hearts, both did consider them the happiest. Ralph wasn't sure that autumn love was the richest love, but he came firmly to believe that it was the kindest and the most fulfilling. "Ah, Lois," he often said and laughed. Lois pretended to be irritated at this, but pretending was all it ever was. She saw the look in his eyes when he said it. On their first Christmas morning as man and wife, they had moved into Lois's tidy little house and put his own white rhino up for sale. Lois gave him a beagle puppy. "Do you like her?" she asked apprehensively. "I almost didn't get her. Dear Abby says you should never give pets as presents, but she looked so sweet in the pet shop window, and so sad. If you don't like her, or don't want to spend the rest of the winter trying to housebreak a puppy, just say so. We'll find someone..." "Lois," he said, giving his eyebrow what he hoped was that special ironic Bill McGovern lift. "You're babbling."
"I am?"
"You am. It's something you do when you're nervous. But you can stop being nervous right now." "I'm crazy about this lady." Nor was that an exaggeration. He fell in love with a black and tan beagle bitch almost at once.
"What will you name her?" Lois asked. "Any idea?"
"Sure," Ralph said. "Rosalie." The next 4 years were, by and large, good ones for Helen and Nat Deepnow as well. They lived frugally in an apartment on the east side of town for a while, getting along on Helen's librarian's salary, but not doing much more than that. The little Cape Cod up the street from Ralph's place had sold, but that money had gone to pay outstanding bills. Then, in June of 1994, Helen received an insurance windfall. Only the wind that blew it her way was John Lydecker. The Great Eastern Insurance Company had originally refused to pay off on Ed Deepnow's life insurance policy, claiming he had taken his own life. Then, after a great deal of harumphing and muttering under their corporate breath, they had offered a substantial settlement. They were persuaded to do this by a poker buddy of John Lydecker's named Howard Heyman. When he wasn't playing lowball, five-card stud, and three-card draw, Heyman was a lawyer who enjoyed lunching on insurance companies. Lydecker had re-met Helen at Ralph and Lois's in February of 1994, had fallen head over heels in fascination with her. It was never quite love, he told Ralph and Lois later, which was probably just as well, considering how things turned out, and had introduced her to Heyman because he thought the insurance company was trying to screw her. He was insane, not suicidal, Lydecker said, and stuck to that long after Helen had handed him his hat and shown him the door. After being faced with a suit in which Howard Heyman threatened to make Great Eastern look like Snidely Whiplash tying Little Nell to the railroad tracks, Helen had received a check for $70,000. In the late fall of 1994, she had used most of this money to buy a house on Harris Avenue, just three doors up from her old place and right across from Harriet Bennigan's. I was never really happy on the East Side, she told Lois one day in November of that year. They were on their way back from the park, and Natalie had been sitting slumped and fast asleep in her stroller, her presence little more than a pink nose tip and a fog of cold breath below a large ski hat which Lois had knitted herself. I used to dream about Harris Avenue. Isn't that crazy? I don't think dreams are ever crazy, Lois replied. Helen and John Lydecker dated for most of that summer, but neither Ralph nor Lois was particularly surprised when the courtship abruptly ended after Labor Day, or when Helen began to wear a discreet pink triangle pin on her prim, high-necked librarian's blouses. Perhaps they were not surprised, because they were old enough to have seen everything at least once, or perhaps on some deep level they were still glimpsing the auras which surround things, creating a bright gateway opening on a secret city of hidden meanings, concealed motives, and camouflaged agendas. Ralph and Lois babysat Natalie frequently after Helen moved back to Harris Avenue, and they enjoyed these stints tremendously. Nat was the child their marriage might have produced if it had happened 30 years sooner, and the coldest, most overcast winter day warmed and brightened when Natalie came toddling in, looking like a midget version of the Goodyear blimp in her pink quilted snowsuit, with the mittens hanging from the cuffs, and yelled exuberantly, "Hi, Ralph! Hi, Lois! I come to visit you!" In June of 1995, Helen bought a reconditioned Volvo. On the back she put a sticker which read, "A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle." This sentiment did not particularly surprise Ralph either, but glimpsing that sticker always made him feel unhappy. He sometimes thought Ed's meanest legacy to his widow was summed up in its brittle, not quite funny sentiment. And when he saw it, Ralph often remembered how Ed had looked on that summer afternoon, when he'd walked up from the Red Apple store to confront him, how Ed had been sitting, shirtless, in the spray thrown by the sprinkler, how there had been a drop of blood on one lens of his glasses, how he had leaned forward, looking at Ralph with his earnest, intelligent eyes, and said that once stupidity reached a certain level, it became hard to live with. And after that, stuff started to happen, Ralph would sometimes think. Just what stuff was something he could no longer remember, though. And probably that was just as well. But his lapse of memory, if that's what it was, did not change his belief that Helen had been cheated in some obscure fashion, that some bad-tempered fate had tied a can to a tail, and she didn't even know it. A month after Helen bought her Volvo, Faye Chapin suffered a heart attack while drafting a preliminary list of seeds for that fall's Runway 3 Classic. He was taken to Derry Home Hospital, where he died 7 hours later. Ralph visited him shortly before the end, and when he saw the numbers on the door, 315, a fierce sense of déjà vu washed over him. At first he thought it was because Carolyn had finished her last illness just up the hall, and then he remembered that Jimmy V had died in this very room. He and Lois had visited Jimmy just before the end, and Ralph thought Jimmy had recognized them both, although he couldn't be sure. His memories of the time when he had first begun to really notice Lois were mixed up and hazy in his mind. He supposed some of that was love, and probably some of it had to do with getting on in years, but probably most of it had been the insomnia.
He'd gone through a really bad patch of that in the months after Carolyn's death, although it had eventually cured itself, as such things sometimes did. Still, it seemed to him that something... Hello, woman. Hello, man. We've been waiting for you. Far out of the ordinary had happened in this room. And as he took Faye's dry, strengthless hand and smiled into Faye's frightened, confused eyes, a strange thought came to him. They're standing right over there in the corner and watching us. He looked over. There was no one at all in the corner, of course. But for a moment, for just a moment... Life in the years between 1993 and 1998 went on as life in places like Derry always does. The buds of April became the brittle blowing leaves of October. Christmas trees were brought into homes in mid-December and hauled off in the backs of dumpsters with strands of tinsel still hanging sadly from their boughs during the first week of January. Babies came in through the indoor and old folks went out through the outdoor. Sometimes people in the prime of their lives went out through the outdoor, too. In Derry, there were 5 years of haircuts and permanents, storms and senior proms, coffee and cigarettes, steak dinners at Parker's Cove, and hot dogs at the Little League field. Girls and boys fell in love, drunks fell out of cars, short skirts fell out of favor. People reshingled their roofs and repaved their driveways. Old bums were voted out of office. New bums were voted in. It was life, often unsatisfying, frequently cruel, usually boring, sometimes beautiful, once in a while exhilarating. The fundamental things continued to apply as time went by. In the early fall of 1996, Ralph became convinced he had colon cancer. He had begun to see more than trace amounts of blood in his stool, and when he finally went to see Dr. Picard, Dr. Litchfield's cheerful, rumpled replacement. He did so with visions of hospital beds and chemotherapy IV drips dancing bleakly in his head. Instead of cancer, the problem turned out to be a hemorrhoid, which had, in Dr. Picard's memorable phrase, popped its top. He wrote Ralph a prescription for suppositories, which Ralph took to the Rite Aid down the street. Joe Weiser read it, then grinned cheerfully at Ralph. Lousy, he said. But it beats the hell out of colon cancer, don't you think? The thought of colon cancer never crossed my mind, Ralph replied stiffly. One day during the winter of 1997, Lois took it into her head to slide down her favorite hill in Strawford Park on that deep-nosed plastic flying saucer sled. She went down faster than a pig in a greased chute. This was Don Veazey's phrase. He just happened to be there that day watching the action and crashed into the side of the port-a-san marked women. She sprained her knee and twisted her back, and although Ralph knew he had no business doing so, it was unsympathetic, to say the least. He laughed hilariously most of the way to the emergency room. The fact that Lois was also howling with laughter despite the pain did nothing to help Ralph regain control. He laughed until tears poured from his eyes and he thought he might have a stroke. She had just looked so goddamned our Lois, going down the hill on that thing, spinning around and around with her legs crossed like one of those yogis from the mysterious East, and she had almost knocked the port-a-san over when she hit it. She was completely recovered by the time spring rolled around, although that knee always ached on rainy nights, and she did get tired of Don Veazey asking, almost every time he saw her, if she'd slid into any shithouses lately. Just life, going on as it always does, which is to say mostly between the lines and outside the margins. It's what happens while we're making other plans, according to some sage or other. And if life was exceptionally good to Ralph Roberts during those years, it might have been because he had no other plans to make. He maintained friendships with Joe Weiser and John Lydecker, but his best friend during those years was his wife. They went almost everywhere together, had no secrets, and fought so seldom one might just as well have said never. He also had Rosalie, the beagle, the rocker that had once been Mr. Chass's and was now his, and almost daily visits from Natalie, who had begun calling them Ralph and Lois
instead of Wolf and Woloth, a change neither of them found to be an improvement. And he was healthy, which was maybe the best thing of all. It was just life, full of short-time rewards and setbacks, and Ralph lived it with enjoyment and serenity until mid-March of 1998, when he awoke one morning, glanced at the digital clock beside his bed, and saw it was 5:49 a.m. He lay quietly beside Lois, not wanting to disturb her by getting up, and wondering what had awakened him.
You know what, Ralph?
No, I don't.
Yes, you do. Listen.
So he listened. He listened very carefully. And after a while, he began to hear it in the walls. The low, soft ticking of the death watch. Ralph awoke at 5:47 the following morning, and at 5:44 the morning after that. His sleep was whittled away, minute by minute, as winter slowly loosened its grip on Derry and allowed spring to find its way back in. By May, he was hearing the tick of the death watch everywhere, but understood it was all coming from one place and simply projecting itself, as a good ventriloquist can project his voice. Before, it had been coming from Carolyn. Now it was coming from him. He felt none of the terror that had gripped him when he'd been so sure he had developed cancer, and none of the desperation he vaguely remembered from his previous bout of insomnia. He tired more easily, and began to find it more difficult to concentrate and remember even simple things. But he accepted what was happening calmly. "Are you sleeping all right, Ralph?" Lois asked him one day. "You're getting these big dark circles under your eyes." "It's the dope I take," Ralph said. "Very funny, you old poop."
He took her in his arms and hugged her.
"Don't worry about me, sweetheart. I'm getting all the sleep I need."
He awoke one morning a week later at 4:02 a.m. with a line of deep heat throbbing in his arm, throbbing in perfect sync with the sound of the death watch, which was, of course, nothing more or less than the beat of his own heart. But this new thing wasn't his heart, or at least Ralph didn't think it was. It felt as if an electric filament had been embedded in the flesh of his forearm. "It's the scar," he thought, and then, "No, it's the promise. The time of the promise is almost here."
"What promise, Ralph? What promise?"
He didn't know. One day in early June, Helen and Nat blew in to visit and tell Ralph and Lois about the trip they had taken to Boston with Aunt Melanie, a bank teller with whom Helen had become close friends. Helen and Aunt Melanie had gone to some sort of feminist convention while Natalie networked with about a billion new kids in the daycare center. And then Aunt Melanie had left to do some more feminist things in New York and Washington. Helen and Nat had stayed on in Boston for a couple of days, just sightseeing. "We went to see a movie cartoon," Natalie said. "It was about animals in the woods. They talked." She pronounced this last word with Shakespearean grandiosity. "Talked." "Movies where animals talk are neat, aren't they?" Lois asked.
"Yes. Also, I got this new dress."
"And a very pretty dress it is," Lois said. Helen was looking at Ralph. "Are you okay, old chum? You look pale, and you haven't said boo."
"Never better," he said. "I was just thinking how cute you two look in those caps. Did you get them at Fenway Park?"
Both Helen and Nat were wearing Boston Red Sox caps. These were common enough in New England during warm weather, common as cat dirt, Lois would have said. But the sight of them on the heads of these two people filled Ralph with some deep, resonant feeling, and it was tied to a specific image, one he did not in the least understand, the front of the Red Apple store. Helen, meantime, had taken off her hat and was examining it.
"Yes," she said. "We went, but we only stayed for 3 innings. Men hitting balls and catching balls. I guess I just don't have much patience for men and their balls these days. But we like our nifty Bow Sox hats, don't we, Natalie?"
"Yes," Natalie agreed smartly. And when Ralph awoke the next morning at 4:01,
The scar throbbed its thin line of heat inside his arm, and the death watch seemed almost to have gained a voice, one which whispered a strange, foreign-sounding name over and over. Atropos, Atropos, Atropos. I know that name. Do you, Ralph? Yes. He was the one with the rusty scalpel and the nasty disposition. The one who called me Shorts. The one who took. Took what, Ralph? He was getting used to these silent discussions. They seemed to come to him on some mental radio band, a pirate frequency that operated only during the little hours, the ones when he lay awake beside his sleeping wife, waiting for the sun to come up. Took what? Do you remember? He didn't expect to. The questions that voice asked him almost always went unanswered. But this time, unexpectedly, an answer came. Bill McGovern's hat, of course. Atropos took Bill's hat, and once I made him so mad, he actually took a bite out of the brim. Who is he? Who is Atropos? Of this he was not so sure. He only knew that Atropos had something to do with Helen, who now owned a Boston Red Sox cap of which she seemed very fond, and that he had a rusty scalpel. Soon, thought Ralph Roberts as he lay in the dark, listening to the soft, steady tick of the death watch in the walls. I'll know soon. During the third week of that baking hot June, Ralph began to see the auras again. As June slipped into July, Ralph found himself bursting into tears often, usually for no discernible reason at all. It was strange. He had no sense of depression or discontent, but sometimes he would look at something, maybe only a bird winging its solitary way across the sky, and his heart would vibrate with sorrow and loss. It's almost over, the inside voice said. It no longer belonged to Carolyn or Bill, or even his own younger self. It was all its own now, the voice of a stranger, although not necessarily an unkind one. That's why you're sad, Ralph. It's perfectly normal to be sad as things start to wind down. Nothing's almost over, he cried back. Why should it be? At my last checkup, Dr. Picard said I was sound as a drum. I'm fine, never better. Silence from the voice inside. But it was a knowing silence. Okay, Ralph said out loud one hot afternoon near the end of July. He was sitting on a bench not far from the place where the Derry standpipe had stood until 1985, when the big storm had come along and knocked it down. At the base of the hill, near the birdbath, a young man, a serious birdwatcher from the binoculars he wore and a thick stack of paperbacks on the grass beside him, was making careful notes in what looked like some sort of journal. Okay, tell me why it's almost over. Just tell me that. There was no immediate answer, but that was all right. Ralph was willing to wait. It had been quite a stroll over here. The day was hot, and he was tired. He was now waking around 3:30 every morning. He had begun taking long walks again, but not in any hope they would help him sleep better or longer. He thought he was making pilgrimages, visiting all his favorite spots in Derry one last time, saying goodbye. Because the time of the promise has almost come, the voice answered, and the scar began to throb with its deep, narrow heat again. The one that was made to you, and the one you made in return. What was it? He asked, agitated. Please, if I made a promise, why can't I remember what it was? The serious birdwatcher heard that and looked up the hill. What he saw was a man sitting on a park bench and apparently having a conversation with himself. The corners of the serious birdwatcher's mouth turned down in disgust, and he thought, I hope I die before I get that old. I really do. Then he turned back to the birdbath and began making notes again. Deep inside Ralph's head, the clenching sensation, that feeling of blink, suddenly came again, and although he didn't stir from the bench,
Ralph felt himself propelled rapidly upward nonetheless, faster and faster than ever before.
"Not at all," the voice said. "Once you were much higher than this, Ralph. Lois, too. But you're getting there. You'll be ready soon."
The bird watcher, who lived all unknowing in the center of a gorgeous spun gold aura, looked around cautiously, perhaps wanting to make sure that the senile old man on the bench at the top of the hill wasn't creeping up on him with a blunt instrument. What he saw caused the tight, prissy line of his mouth to soften in astonishment. His eyes widened. Ralph observed sudden radiating spokes of indigo in the serious birdwatcher's aura and realized he was looking at shock.
"What's the matter with him? What does he see?"
But that was wrong. It wasn't what the birdwatcher saw. It was what he didn't see. He didn't see Ralph, because Ralph had gone up high enough to disappear from this level, had become the visual equivalent of a note blown on a dog whistle. If they were here now, I could see them easily.
Who, Ralph? If who was here?
Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos.
All at once, the pieces began to fly together in his mind, like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that had looked a great deal more complicated than it actually was. Ralph, whispering,
"Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!"
Six days later, Ralph awoke at 3:15 in the morning and knew that the time of the promise had come.
"I think I'll walk up street to the Red Apple and get an ice cream bar," Ralph said. It was almost 10:00. His heart was beating much too fast, and his thoughts were hard to find under the constant white noise of terror which now filled him. He had never felt less like ice cream in his entire life, but it was a reasonable enough excuse for a trip to the Red Apple. It was the first week of August, and the weatherman had said the mercury would probably top 90 by early afternoon, with thunderstorms to follow in the early evening. Ralph thought he needn't worry about the thunderstorms. A bookcase stood on a spread of newspapers by the kitchen door. Lois had been painting it barn red. Now she got to her feet, put her hands into the small of her back, and stretched. Ralph could hear the minute crackling sounds of her spine. "I'll go with you. My head'll ache tonight if I don't get away from that paint for a while. I don't know why I wanted to paint on such a muggy day in the first place." The last thing on earth Ralph wanted was to be accompanied up to the Red Apple by Lois. "You don't have to, honey. I'll bring you back one of those coconut popsicles you like. I wasn't even planning on taking Rosalie. It's so humid. Go sit on the back porch, why don't you? Any popsicle you carry back from the store on a day like this will be falling off the stick by the time you get it here," she said. "Come on, let's go while there's still shade on this side of the..." She trailed off. The little smile she'd been wearing slipped off her face. It was replaced by a look of dismay, and the gray of her aura, which had only darkened slightly during the years Ralph hadn't been able to see it, now began to glow with flocks of reddish-pink embers. "Ralph, what's wrong? What are you really going to do?" "Nothing," he said, but the scar was glowing inside his arm, and the tick of the death watch was everywhere, loud and everywhere. It was telling him he had an appointment to keep, a promise to keep. "Yes, there is, and it's been wrong for the last 2 or 3 months, maybe longer. I'm a foolish woman. I knew something was happening, but I couldn't bring myself to look at it dead on, because I was afraid, and I was right to be afraid, wasn't I? I was right. Lois..." She was suddenly crossing the room to him, crossing fast, almost leaping, the old back injury not slowing her down in the least. And before he could stop her, she had seized his right arm and was holding it out, looking at it fixedly. The scar was glowing a fierce, bright red. Ralph had a moment to hope that it was strictly an aural glow, and she wouldn't be able to see it. Then she looked up, her eyes round and full of terror. Terror and something else. Ralph thought that something else was recognition. "Oh, my God," she whispered. "The men in the park, the ones with the funny names, clothes and lashes, something like that, and one of them cut you. Oh, Ralph, oh, my God, what are you supposed to do? Now, Lois, don't take on. Don't you dare tell me not to take on, she shrieked into his face. Don't you dare, don't you dare. Hurry, the interior voice whispered. You don't have time to stand around and discuss this. Somewhere it's already begun to happen, and the death watch you hear may not be ticking just for you. I have to go. He turned and blundered toward the door. In his agitation, he did not notice a certain Sherlock Holmesian circumstance attending this scene. A dog which should have barked. A dog which always barked her stern disapproval when voices were raised in this house, but did not. Rosalie was missing from her usual place by the screen door, and the door itself was standing ajar. Rosalie was the first thing from Ralph's mind at that moment. He felt knee-deep in molasses and thought he would be doing well just to make the porch, let alone the red apple up the street. His heart thumped and skidded in his chest. His eyes were burning. No, Lois screamed. No, Ralph, please, please don't leave me. She ran after him, clutched his arm. She was still holding her paintbrush, and the fine red droplets which splattered his shirt looked like blood. Now she was crying, and her expression of utter, abject sorrow nearly broke his heart. He didn't want to leave her like this. Wasn't sure he could leave her like this. He turned and took her by her forearms. Lois, I have to go. You haven't been sleeping, she babbled. I knew that, and I knew it meant something was wrong, but it doesn't matter. We'll go away. We can leave right now, this minute. We'll just take Rosalie and our toothbrushes and go. He squeezed her arms and she stopped, looking up at him with her wet eyes. Her lips were trembling. Lois, listen to me. I have to do this.
I lost Paul. I can't lose you too, she wailed. I couldn't stand it. Oh, Ralph, I couldn't stand it.
You'll be able to, he thought. Short-timers are a lot tougher than they look. They have to be. Ralph felt a couple of tears trickle down his cheeks. He suspected their source was more weariness than grief. If he could make her see that all this changed nothing, only made what he had to do harder. He held her at arm's length. The scar on his arm was throbbing more fiercely than ever, and the feeling of time slipping relentlessly away had become overwhelming. "Walk with me at least part way, if you want," he said. "Maybe you can even help me do what I have to do. I've had my life, Lois, and a fine one it was. But she hasn't really had anything yet, and I'll be damned if I let that son of a bitch have her just because he's got a score to settle with me."
What son of a bitch? Ralph, what in the world are you talking about?
I'm talking about Natalie Deepnow. She's supposed to die this morning. Only I'm not going to let that happen.
Nat? Ralph, why would anyone want to hurt Nat?
She looked very bewildered, very our Lois. But wasn't there something else beneath that daffy exterior? Something careful and calculating? Ralph thought the answer was yes. Ralph had an idea Lois wasn't half as bewildered as she was pretending to be. She had fooled McGovern for years with that act. Him, too, at least part of the time. And this was just another, and rather brilliant, variation of the same old scam. What she was really trying to do was hold him here. She loved Nat deeply, but to Lois, a choice between her husband and the little girl who lived up the lane was no choice at all. She didn't consider either age or questions of fairness to have any bearing on the situation. Ralph was her man, and to Lois, that was all that mattered. It won't work, he said, not unkindly. He disengaged himself and started for the door again. I made a promise, and I'm all out of time.
Break it, then, she cried, and the mixture of terror and rage in her voice stunned him. I don't remember much about that time, but I remember we got involved with things that almost got us killed, and for reasons we couldn't even understand. So break it, Ralph. Better your promise than my heart.
And what about the kid? What about Helen, for that matter? Nat's all she lives for. Doesn't Helen deserve something better from me than a broken promise?
I don't care what she deserves, what any of them deserve, she shouted. And then her face crumpled. Yes, all right, I suppose I do. But what about us, Ralph? Don't we count?
Her eyes, those dark and eloquent Spanish eyes of hers, pleaded with him. If he looked into them too long, it would become all too easy to cry it off. So Ralph looked away. I mean to do it, honey. And that's going to get what you and I have already had. Another 70 years or so of days and nights. She looked at him helplessly, but made no attempt to stop him again. Instead, she began to cry.
Foolish old man, she whispered. Foolish, willful old man.
Yes, I suppose, he said, and lifted her chin. But I'm a foolish, willful old man of my word. Come with me. I'd like that.
All right, Ralph.
She could hardly hear her own voice, and her skin was as cold as clay. Her aura had gone almost completely red.
What is it? What's going to happen to her?
She's going to be hit by a green Ford sedan. Unless I take her place, she's going to be splashed all over Harris Avenue. And Helen's going to see it happen. As they walked up the hill toward the Red Apple, at first Lois kept falling behind, then trotting to catch up. But she quit when she saw she could not slow him with such a simple trick. Ralph told her what little more he could. She had some memory of being under the lightning-struck tree out by the extension, a memory she had believed, at least until this morning, to be the memory of a dream. But of course she hadn't been there during Ralph's final confrontation with Atropos. Ralph told her of it now, of the random death Atropos intended Natalie to suffer if Ralph continued standing in the way of his plans. He told her of how he'd extracted a promise from Clotho and Lachesis that Atropos might in this case be overruled and Nat saved.
I have an idea that the decision was made very near the top of this crazy building. This tower they kept talking about. Maybe at the very top.
He was panting out the words, and his heart was beating more rapidly than ever. But he thought most of that could be attributed to the fast walk and the torrid day. His fear had subsided somewhat. Talking to Lois had done that much. Now he could see the Red Apple. Mrs. Perrine was at the bus stop, half a block farther up, standing straight as a general, reviewing troops. Her net shopping bag hung over her arm. There was a bus shelter nearby, and it was shady inside, but Mrs. Perrine stolidly ignored its existence. Even in the dazzling sunlight, he could see that her aura was the same West Point gray as it had been on that October evening in 1993. Of Helen and Nat, there was as yet no sign.
Of course I knew who he was,
Esther Perrine later tells the reporter from the Derry News.
Do I look incompetent to you, young man? Or senile? I've known Ralph Roberts for over 20 years. A good man. Not cut from the same cloth as his first wife, of course. Carolyn was a Satterwaite from the Bangor Satterwaites, but a very fine man just the same. I recognized the driver of that green Ford auto, too, right away. Pete Sullivan delivered my paper for 6 years, and he did a good job. The new one, the Morrison boy, always throws it in my flower beds or up on the porch roof. Pete was driving with his mother on his learner's permit, I understand. I hope he won't take on too much about what happened, for he's a good lad, and it really wasn't his fault. I saw the whole thing, and I'll take my oath on it. I suppose you think I'm rambling. Don't bother denying it. I can read your face just like it was your own newspaper. Never mind, though. I've said most of what I have to say. I knew it was Ralph right away, but there's something you'll get wrong, even if you put it in your story, which you probably won't. He came from nowhere to save that little girl.
Esther Perrine fixes the respectfully silent young reporter with a formidable glance, fixes him as a lepidopterist might fix a butterfly on a pin after administering the chloroform.
I don't mean it was like he came from nowhere, young man, although I bet that's what you'll print.
She leans toward the reporter, her eyes never leaving his face, and says it again.
He came from nowhere to save that little girl. Do you follow me? From nowhere.
The accident made the front page of the following day's Derry News. Esther Perrine was sufficiently colorful in her remarks to warrant a sidebar of her own, and staff photographer Tom Matthews got a picture to go with it that made her look like Ma Jode in The Grapes of Wrath. The headline of the sidebar read, "It was like he came from nowhere. Eyewitness to tragedy says." When she read it, Mrs. Perrine was not at all surprised. "In the end, I got what I wanted," Ralph said. "But only because Clotho and Lachesis, and whoever it is they work for on the upper levels, were desperate to stop Ed."
"Upper levels? What upper levels? What building?"
"Never mind. You've forgotten, but remembering wouldn't change anything. The point is just this, Lois. They didn't want to stop Ed because thousands of people would have died if he'd hit the Civic Center dead on. They wanted to stop him because there was one person whose life needed to be preserved at any cost, in their reckoning anyway. When I was finally able to make them see that I felt the same about my kid as they did about theirs, arrangements were made."
"That's when they cut you, wasn't it? And when you made the promise, the one you used to talk about in your sleep."
He shot her a wide-eyed, startled, and heartbreakingly boyish glance. She only looked back. "Yes," he said, and wiped his forehead. "I guess so." The air lay in his lungs like metal shavings. "A life for a life. That was the deal. Natalie's in exchange for mine, and..."
"Hey, quit trying to wiggle away. Quit it, Rover, or I'll kick your asshole square."
Ralph broke off at the sound of that shrill, hectoring, horridly familiar voice. A voice no human being on Harris Avenue but him could hear, and looked across the street.
"Ralph, what?"
"Shh." He pulled her back against the summer dry hedge in front of the Applebaum's house. He wasn't doing anything so polite as perspiring now. His whole body was crawling with a stinking sweat as heavy as engine oil, and he could feel every gland in his body dumping a hot load into his blood. His underwear was trying to crawl up into the crack of his ass and disappear. His tongue tasted like a blown fuse. Lois followed the direction of his gaze.
"Rosalie," she cried. "Rosalie, you bad dog. What are you doing over there?"
The black and tan beagle she had given Ralph on their first Christmas was across the street, standing, except cringing was actually the word for what she was doing, on the sidewalk in front of the house where Helen and Nat had lived until Ed had popped his wig. For the first time in the years they'd had her, the beagle reminded Lois of Rosalie number one. Rosalie number two appeared to be all alone over there, but that did not allay Lois's sudden terror.
"Oh, what have I done?" she thought. "What have I done?" "Rosalie!" she screamed. "Rosalie, get over here!"
The dog heard. Lois could see that she did, but she didn't move.
"Ralph, what's happening over there?"
"Shh," he said again, and then just a little farther up the street, Lois saw something which stopped her breath. Her last unstated hope that all this was happening only in Ralph's head, that it was a kind of flashback to their previous experience, disappeared because now their dog had company. Holding a skip rope looped over her right arm, 6-year-old Nat Deepnoe came to the end of her walk and looked down the street toward a house she didn't remember ever living in, toward a lawn where her shirtless father, an undesignated player named Ed Deepnoe, had once sat among intersecting rainbows, listening to the Jefferson airplane as a single spot of blood dried on his John Lennon spectacles. Natalie looked down the street and smiled happily at Rosalie, who was panting and watching her with miserable, frightened eyes. "Atropos doesn't see me," Ralph thought. "He's concentrating on Rosie, and on Natalie, of course, and he doesn't see me." Everything had come around with a sort of hideous perfection. The house was there, Rosalie was there, and Atropos was there too, wearing a hat cocked back on his head and looking like a wiseacre news reporter in a 1950s B picture,
Something directed by Ida Lupino, perhaps. Only this time, it wasn't a Panama with a bite gone from the brim. This time, it was a Boston Red Sox cap, and it was too small even for Atropos, because the adjustable band in the back had been pulled all the way over to the last hole. It had to be, in order to fit the head of the little girl who owned it. All we need now is Pete the paperboy, and the show would be perfect, Ralph thought. The final scene of Insomnia, or Short Time Life on Harris Avenue, a tragicomedy in three acts. Everyone takes a bow and then exits stage right. This dog was afraid of Atropos, just as Rosalie No. 1 had been. And the main reason the little bald doc hadn't seen Ralph and Lois was that he was trying to keep her from running off before he was ready. And here came Nat, headed down the sidewalk toward her favorite dog in the whole world, Ralph and Lois's Rosie. Her jump rope, 369, hun, the goose drank wine, was slung over her arm. She looked impossibly beautiful and impossibly fragile in her sailor shirt and blue shorts. Her pigtails bounced. It's happening too fast, Ralph thought. Everything is happening much too fast.
Not at all, Ralph. You did splendidly 5 years ago. You'll do splendidly now.
It sounded like Clotho, but there was no time to look. A green car was coming slowly down Harris Avenue from the direction of the airport, moving with a sort of agonized care which usually meant a driver who was very old or very young. Agonized care or not, it was unquestionably the car. A dirty membrane hung over it like a shroud. Life is a wheel, Ralph thought, and it occurred to him that this was not the first time the idea had occurred to him. Sooner or later, everything you thought you'd left behind comes around again. For good or ill, it comes around again. Rosie made another abortive lunge for freedom, and as Atropos yanked her back, losing his hat, Nat knelt before her and patted her.
Are you lost, girl? Did you get out by yourself? That's okay. I'll take you home.
She gave Rosie a hug, her small arms passing through Atropos's arms, her small, beautiful face only inches from his ugly, grinning one. Then she got up.
Come on, Rosie. Come on, sugar pie.
Rosalie started down the sidewalk at Nat's heel, looking back once at the grinning little man and whining uneasily. On the other side of Harris Avenue, Helen came out of the Red Apple, and the last condition of the vision Atropos had shown Ralph was fulfilled. Helen had a loaf of bread in one hand. Her Red Sox hat was on her head. Ralph swept Lois into his arms and kissed her fiercely. I love you with all my heart, he said. Remember that, Lois. I know you do, she said calmly. And I love you. That's why I can't let you do it. She seized him around the neck, her arms like bands of iron, and he felt her breasts push against him hard as she drew in all the breath her lungs could hold.
Go away, you rotten bastard, she screamed. I can't see you, but I know you're there. Go away! Go away and leave us alone!
Natalie stopped dead in her tracks and looked at Lois with wide-eyed surprise. Rosalie stopped beside her, ears pricking.
Don't go into the street, Nat! Lois screamed at her. Don't!
Then her hands, which had been laced together at the back of Ralph's neck, were holding nothing. Her arms, which had been locked about his shoulders in a death grip, were empty. He was gone like smoke. Atropos looked toward the cry of alarm and saw Ralph and Lois standing on the other side of Harris Avenue. More important, he saw Ralph seeing him. His eyes widened, his lips parted in a hateful snarl. One hand flew to his bald pate. It was crisscrossed with old scars, the remnants of wounds made with his own scalpel, in an instinctive gesture of defense that was 5 years too late.
Fuck you, Shorts! This little bitch is mine!
Ralph saw Nat looking at Lois with uncertainty and surprise. He heard Lois shrieking at her, telling her not to go into the street. Then it was Lachesis he heard, speaking from some place close by.
Come up, Ralph. As far as you can. Quickly.
He felt the clench in the center of his head, felt that brief swoop of vertigo in his stomach. and suddenly the whole world brightened and filled with color. He half saw and half felt Lois's arms and locked hands collapse inward, through the place where his body had been a moment before. And then he was drawing away from her. No, being carried away from her. He felt the pull of some great current, and understood, in a vague way, that if there was such a thing as a higher purpose, he had joined it, and would soon be swept downriver with it. Natalie and Rosalie were now standing directly in front of the house which Ralph had once shared with Bill McGovern before selling up and moving into Lois's house. Nat glanced doubtfully at Lois, then waved tentatively.
"She's okay, Lois. See, she's right here." She patted Rosalie's head. "I'll cross her safe. Don't worry."
Then as she started into the street, she called to her mother.
"I can't find my baseball cap. I think somebody stole it."
Rosalie was still on the sidewalk. Nat turned to her impatiently.
"Come on, girl."
The green car was moving in the child's direction, but very slowly. It did not at first look like much of a danger to her. Ralph recognized the driver at once, and he did not doubt his senses or suspect he was having a hallucination. In that instant, it seemed very right that the approaching sedan should be piloted by his old paper boy.
"Natalie!"
Lois screamed.
"Natalie! No!"
Atropos darted forward and slapped Rosalie number two on the rump.
"Get out of here, mutt! Go on, before I change my mind!"
Atropos spared Ralph one final grimacing leer as Rosalie yelped and darted into the street, and into the path of the Ford driven by 16-year-old Pete Sullivan. Natalie didn't see the car. She was looking at Lois, whose face was all red and scary. It had finally occurred to Nat that Lois wasn't screaming about Rosie at all, but something else entirely. Pete registered the sprinting beagle. It was the little girl he didn't see. He swerved to avoid Rosalie, a maneuver that ended with a Ford aimed directly at Natalie. Ralph could see two frightened faces behind the windshield as the car veered, and he thought Mrs. Sullivan was screaming. Atropos was leaping up and down, doing an obscenely joyful hornpipe.
"Yeah! Short time! Silly white hair! Told you I'd fix you!"
In slow motion, Helen dropped the loaf of bread she was holding.
"Natalie, look out!"
she shrieked. Ralph ran. Again there was that clear sensation of moving by thought alone, and as he closed in on Nat, now diving forward with his hands stretched out, aware of the car looming just beyond her, kicking bright arrows of sun through its dark death bag and into his eyes, he clenched his mind again, bringing himself back down to the short-time world for the last time. He fell into a landscape that rang with splintered screams. Helen's mingled with Lois's, mingled with the ones being made by the tires of the Ford. Weaving its way through them like an outlaw vine was the sound of Atropos's jeers. Ralph got a brief glimpse of Nat's wide blue eyes, and then he shoved her in the chest and stomach as hard as he could, sending her flying backward with her hands and feet thrust out in front of her. She landed sitting up in the gutter, bruising her tailbone on the curb, but breaking nothing. From some distant place, Ralph heard Atropos squawk in fury and disbelief. Then 2 tons of Ford, still traveling at 20 miles an hour, struck Ralph, and the soundtrack dropped dead. He was heaved upward and backward in a low, slow arc. It felt slow, anyway from inside, and went with the Ford's hood ornament imprinted on his cheek like a tattoo, and one broken leg trailing behind him. There was time to see his shadow sliding along the pavement beneath him in a shape like an X. There was time to see a spray of red droplets in the air just above him, and to think that Lois must have splattered more paint on him than he had thought at first. And there was time to see Natalie sitting at the side of the street, weeping but all right, and to sense Atropos on the sidewalk behind her, shaking his fists and dancing with rage. "I believe I did pretty damn good for an old geezer," Ralph thought, "but now I think I could really do with a nap." Then he came back to earth with a terrible mortal smack and rolled, skull fracturing, back breaking, lungs punctured by brittle thorns of bone as his rib cage exploded, liver turning to pulp, intestines first coming unanchored and then rupturing. And nothing hurt. Nothing at all.
Lois never forgot the awful thud that was the sound of Ralph's return to Harris Avenue, or the bloody splash marks he left behind as he cartwheeled to a stop. She wanted to scream, but dared not. Some deep, true voice told her that if she did that, the combination of shock, horror, and summer heat would send her unconscious to the sidewalk, and when she came to again, Ralph would be beyond her. She ran instead of screaming, losing one shoe, marginally aware that Pete Sullivan was getting out of the Ford, which had come to rest almost exactly where Joe Wise's car, also a Ford, had come to rest after Joe had hit Rosalie number one all those years ago. She was also marginally aware that Pete was screaming. She reached Ralph and fell on her knees beside him, seeing that his shape had somehow been changed by the green Ford, that the body beneath the familiar chino pants and paint-splattered shirt was fundamentally different from the body which had been pressed against hers less than a minute ago. But his eyes were open, and they were bright and aware. Ralph? Yes. His voice was clear and strong, unmarked by either confusion or pain. Yes, Lois, I hear you. She started to put her arms around him and hesitated, thinking about how you weren't supposed to move people who had been badly injured because you might hurt them even worse or kill them. Then she looked at him again, at the blood pouring from the sides of his mouth and the way his lower body seemed to have come unhinged from the upper part, and decided it would be impossible to hurt Ralph more than he had been hurt already. She hugged him, leaning close, leaning into the smells of disaster, blood and the sweet, sour acetone odor of spent adrenaline on the outrush of his breath.
You did it this time, didn't you? Lois asked.
She kissed his cheek, his blood-soaked eyebrows, his bloody forehead, where the skin had been peeled away from his skull in a flap. She began to cry.
Look at you. Shirt torn, pants torn. Do you think clothes grow on trees?
Is he all right? Helen asked from behind her. Lois didn't turn around, but she saw the shadows on the street. Helen with her arm around her weeping daughter's shoulders, and Rosie standing by Helen's right leg.
He saved Nat's life, and I didn't even see where he came from. Please, Lois, say he's all right.
Then the shadow shifted, as Helen moved to a place where she could actually see Ralph, and she pulled Nat's face against her blouse and began to wail. Lois leaned closer to Ralph, caressing his cheeks with the palms of her hands, wanting to tell him that she had meant to come with him. She had meant to, yes, but in the end he had been too quick for her. In the end he had left her behind. Love you, sweetheart, Ralph said. He reached up and copied her gesture with his own palm. He tried to raise his left hand as well, but it would only lie on the pavement and twitch. Lois took his hand and kissed it.
Love you too, Ralph. Always. So much.
I had to do it, you see? Yes. She didn't know if she did see, didn't know if she would ever see, but she knew he was dying.
Yes, I see.
He sighed harshly. That sweet acetone smell wafted up to her again and smiled.
Miss Chess, Miss Roberts, I mean.
It was Pete speaking in hitching gasps.
Is Mr. Roberts okay? Please say I didn't hurt him.
Stay away, Pete, she said without turning around. Ralph is fine. He just tore his pants and shirt a little. Didn't you, Ralph?
Yes, he said. You bet. You'll just have to horsewhip me for...
He broke off and looked to her left. No one was there, but Ralph smiled anyway. Lachesis, he said. He put out his trembling, blood-grimy right hand, and as Lois, Helen, and Pete Sullivan watched, it rose and fell twice in the empty air. Ralph's eyes moved again, this time to the right. Slowly, very slowly, he moved his hand in that direction. When he spoke this time, his voice had begun to fade.
Hi, Clotho. Now remember, this doesn't hurt, right?
Ralph appeared to listen and then smiled.
Yep, he whispered. Any way you can get her.
His hand rose and fell again in the air,
then dropped back to his chest. He looked up at Lois with his fading blue eyes.
"Listen,"
he said, speaking with great effort. Yet his eyes blazed, would not let us go.
"Every day I woke up next to you was like waking up young and seeing everything new."
He tried to raise his hand to her cheek again and could not.
"Every day, Lois. It was like that for me too, Ralph. Like waking up young." "Lois?"
"What?"
"The ticking," he said.
He swallowed and then said it again, enunciating the words with great effort.
"The ticking."
"What ticking?"
"Never mind.
It stopped," he said, and smiled brilliantly. Then Ralph stopped too. Clotho and Lachesa stood watching Lois weep over the man who lay dead in the street. In one hand, Clotho held his scissors. He raised the other to eye level and looked at it wonderingly. It glowed and blazed with Ralph's aura. Clotho.
"He's here. In here. How wonderful."
Lachesa raised his own right hand. Like Clotho's left, it looked as if someone had pulled a blue mitten over the normal green-gold aura which swaddled it. Lachesis.
"Yes, he was a wonderful man."
Clotho.
"Shall we give him to her?"
Lachesis.
"Can we?"
Clotho.
"There's one way to find out."
They approached Lois, each placed the hand Ralph had shaken on one side of Lois's face.
"Mummy,"
Natalie Deepnot cried. In her agitation, she had reverted to the patois of her babyhood.
"Who those little men? Why they touching Rose?"
"Shh, honey," Helen said, and buried Nat's head against her breast again. There were no men, little or otherwise, near Lois Roberts. She was kneeling alone in the street next to the man who had saved her daughter's life. Lois looked up suddenly, her eyes wide and surprised, a grief forgotten as a gorgeous feeling of light, blue light. Calmness and peace filled her. For a moment, Harris Avenue was gone. She was in a dark place filled with the sweet smells of hay and cows, a dark place that was split by 100 brilliant seams of light. She never forgot the fierce joy that leaped up in her at that moment, nor the sure sense that she was seeing a representation of a universe that Ralph wanted her to see. A universe where there was dazzling light behind the darkness. Couldn't she see it through the cracks?
"Can you ever forgive me?"
Pete was sobbing.
"Oh my God, can you ever forgive me?"
"Oh yes, I think so," Lois said calmly. She passed her hand down Ralph's face, closing his eyes, and then held his head in her lap and waited for the police to come. To Lois, Ralph looked as if he had gone to sleep. And, she saw, a long white scar on his right forearm was gone.